or an assignment 2 weeks ago, if you remember how long ago what that was. Do you remember? Do you remember, anybody remember what I asked you to do?
Ask somebody else what the Bible is. Is it a contract?
That's right. Give her a hand.
Yay.
Now, who else was too embarrassed to say that, but was going to say it? If I only had a prize. That's in my lesson. I thought I'd ask it up front here just to, you know, not break up the flow. You know, I get on these subjects. We're on the Bible as a contract subject. And it seems like it takes three weeks for me to get the total subject out and repeat it enough so that I think maybe you might remember it. For example, what we just did. So we're going to do a little more on the Bible as a contract, but we're going somewhere with this, and I want to underscore some things about this that we probably get some pushback at some places, and that's why I ask you. Did you ask anybody, by the way? Did you get a chance to? You just remember what you're supposed to do. Well, does he get any points for that? Well, you still do it. I mean, you might just find it interesting when you ask somebody, I mean, even your friends, go to church here, you know, what is the Bible? What is it in its nature? What is it that you could say that it is, you know, that kind of core essence thing, which is what I'm trying to do here, this front part. The idea, at least in the beginning of this series, is to establish the nature of the Bible. The Bible is something by its nature, the inherent features, especially when seen as a characteristic of all of it. And we need to determine what it is, what is its innate or essential quality or character. And I think we need to start there, because we get confused. If we don't know what it is, I mean, we're going to really be in trouble, I think. So here's my questions for your discoveries, which we already did. So I went to the internet to a authority on the Bible called the American Bible Society. I figured if anybody knows what the Bible is, they should know, right? I mean, the Bible Society, they are about distributing the Word of God in the world, sharing God's Word with the world. So I thought I would go there and see once what they would say. Now, if the Bible is by its nature, if the Bible is by its nature not a contract, then what is it? I'm not saying they're not going to say that, but I said, well, let's go out and see what the Bible, International Bible Society, says. Okay, they say the Bible is a collection, these are quotes right off the website. The Bible is a collection of sacred texts or scriptures that Jews and Christians consider to be a product of divine inspiration, and a record of the relationship between God and humans. Many different authors contributed to the Bible. Now, is that a wrong statement? I mean, just the statement itself, is that a wrong statement? No, it's fine. It's fine. They say, make sure you don't know who we're doing here, they say the Bible is the account of God's action in the world, his purpose with all creation. The writing of the Bible took place over 16 centuries and is the work of over 40 human authors. It is quite an amazing collection of 66 books with very different styles, all containing the message God desired us to have. Anything wrong with that statement? I mean, in the statement. No, it probably looks okay. But they say it is a guide for living life to the full. It gives us a roadmap for the perilous journey of life. Or to put it another way, on our voyage through life's ocean, the Bible is an anchor. Another one is a storehouse of wonderful stories for children, grown-ups. Remember Noah and the Ark, Joseph's coat with many colors, Daniel in the lion's den, Jonah the fish, the parables of Jesus. These stories emphasize the triumphs and failures of ordinary people. Are we still okay with this? You don't like the nice stories, okay. All right, it's okay to be objectionable here, you know, it's all right. They go on to say it's a refuge in trouble. People in pain and suffering, in prison and in mourning, tell how turning to the Bible brought strength in their desperate hour, a treasure of insight as to who we are. We are not meaningless robots, but we are magnificent creatures of a God who loves us and gives us a purpose and a destiny. Dave? I guess it's okay, all right? I mean, you can't say, well, that's wrong. You can't really say that. Finally, they say it's a source. We're going to finally get to it. Now, finally, they say the source book for everyday living. We find standards for our conduct, guidelines for knowing right from wrong, the principles to help us in a confused society where so often anything goes. So are we okay with what it has said? Probably. But it really didn't answer the question of what is the Bible. It did list things about the Bible that are true. It's a record. It's an account. It's a collection of books. It's a message. It's a guide. It's a map. It's an anchor. I like the anchor, you know. Stops you from going somewhere. It's a storehouse. It's stories. It's a refuge. It's a treasury. It's a source book. It's a guideline. It's a product of divine inspiration. But missing from this list is anything about its accuracy, its infallibility, its inerrancy, without error, without prejudice, or its exclusiveness. Still didn't say anything about that, even about what I'm talking about. So this list is absolutely not offensive. My conclusion, it would be hard to find a person in the whole world that would object to a book that provides all the benefits that are offered. Even the Muslims, the Hindus, even the atheists could occasionally consult the book for these advantages. Nothing suggests a human obligation or a statement of human condition or the actions of God in the future in light of the human condition. So at this point, I'm not going to be a critic of the American Bible Society. They do intend to distribute the book of books. While they may like to present a soft and milder look, the lion therein cannot be tamed. It does not need to be released. It needs to be released into the wild, where it will do its work regardless of the lack of clarity of the sending agency. So if they want to distribute the Bible, it says, go for it. Because what you got to do is release the tiger in it, or lion, as they sometimes say. So what God will do? This may be interesting, this list, but nowhere do these characterizations of the Bible approach the concept of an obligation or a commitment or a promise or some kind of contractual statement regarding what God will do. That is totally missing. So you think a little bit of what we're doing here, we're trying to clarify what's missing. And what we have just read is commonly understood what the Bible is. That's why we're doing this, because that's not what it is. What God will do. In many ways, I don't want to be offensive here, but in many ways, the description given by the International Bible Society could, without too much stretching, be my file cabinet in my office. It could contain all the benefits if I file them there. I just need to access them as needed. It does not condemn me for any action. In fact, it doesn't even talk to me. It's just waiting to be of service. And I came up with it. I was sitting there, and there was my filing cabinet. I said, you know, that guy there could fit the description we just read. He can write stuff in it, and I access it, look in it, read it, and I get some benefit from it. You know, and it's filed in order, you know, with certain things in it. Certain things are not in it, but what I need is in it. So, what is it? Okay. But what happens to our thinking? What happens to our thinking when we consider the Bible and its unifying principle as a statement of what God is going to do? I put this on the board over here. Contracts are about the future. You know, maybe it may say things about the past, but you can't do much about the past, can you? But you can do something about the future. So the contracts are about the future. As far as I know, every contract that I've ever seen could imagine is about the future. You can't bind the past. So what we want to know is what the contract will do in the future, what God will do in the future. And we call ourselves the futurist premillennialist. The question came up this morning, what are we? And that's what we are. Because it's in the future, and we believe Christ will come before the millennium. And we also think he'll come before the tribulation. So it's pre-tribulational, premillennial, futurist. We want to get big, long names strung together. So what happens to our thinking when we consider the Bible as a statement of what God is going to do? And it contains warnings and it contains provisions as well. The Bible is not about God's cooperating with a secondary party. It is declaring what he will do. And we'll talk about this unilateral business later. He does not consult others. Therefore, if the Bible, by its nature, is telling us what God is going to do, now here's the catch. It takes on a fearful and terrifying persona. If we know what God's going to do in the future, it ought to scare everybody to death. Or out of death into life, we hope. But just think about that. If all of a sudden we're looking at the Bible as something that we know is going to happen. Now, maybe you work through this, but a lot of people haven't done this yet. I'm not even sure unbelievers have thought about this. Well, you know, the Bible's a good book. God tells us what he's doing, you know. But all of a sudden we see that God's going to tell us what he's going to do. And as I'll show in a minute here, he's got all the power. Then we should be a little bit fearful. In fact, the Bible calls it, we should be fearful. We stand in awe sometimes. We use that word. God did not consult others in this, what he will do. Therefore, if the Bible, by its nature, is telling us what God is going to do, it takes on a fearful persona. Okay. Then by its nature, it gains infinite significance. If God has, let's say it this way, if God has all the cards, we have nothing. We can't even play in the game. So all of a sudden, this whole issue of the contract and what God is doing with it is significant. And it is the highest and most to be feared authority. At the end, what we do not like, human beings do not like the idea of being under an authority. We want to be the authority. So all of this is absent from the ideas about the Bible that we'd read from the American Bible Society. And I know the Bible Society is putting down a soft front. But it's misleading, I think, you know. So persuasive. I will do, we saw it in Genesis 5 times, plus 2 more. I will do thus affects every atom of the universe. And by the way, if it goes that far, it's a terrifying thing. It's a petrifying thought that no one can escape his grasp. That's why I don't want to consider the Bible, a contract. Because I can wiggle out of it in my mind at least and go to bed thinking, well, I'm just not, I'm not obligated here. Well, once a person recognizes the Bible as a contract, his attitude should be to discover its terms. What does it say? What are the provisions of it? The good and the bad, you might say. As we have said, this has tremendous and fearful implications. The Bible as contract shows man in a weakened position, or I should just say weak position, with no power at all. Conversely, we see God has it all. You know, first thing that does to us, first thing it does to the flesh is make us mad. Why does God have all this power? I don't have any. I mean, I don't have a chance. You're getting close to the truth here. All right, so God has it all. At this point, man has a fearful choice. Submit to God and his authority, or deny that authority by deconstructing the contract. No, it's not a contract. It's just, good sayings, things we live by, American Bible Society style. All right? To deny that authority by deconstructing the contract, as it is only a collection of stuff like my file cabinet, totally safe, and just there for my benefit. Well, if the Bible is not a contract, which God obligates himself, but a file cabinet full of ideas to be accessed by man in his difficulties, to be sure, the enemy of our soul has tricked us. Using our capacity, and we have this capacity to deny God's edifice, what he's building, is revelation. So Satan sets out to build his own. So God says he's made a contract. Satan says, no, he did not. And man is willingly compliant with that. He says, no, he did not. So we have the stalemate. Well, it's interesting. Job says in Job 27:2, first line there says, as God lives, who has taken away my right? He recognizes that God has taken away his right. He doesn't have a vote. He doesn't have a choice. Remember the story of Job. He doesn't have a choice. And his friends are trying to give him all kinds of reasons why maybe he should curse God and die. But, Job doesn't do that. But he also recognizes God doesn't give him a choice. I mean, God is passing down to him what he intended for Job, and it was a test, as we know. So just for us, it is possible that we as believers want to avoid the idea of the Bible as a contract for the same reason. Surely where God obligates himself in an area of his gracious provision, we like that. But the same God who obligates himself to afford righteousness may seem a bit dreadful for us. There's no wiggle room here. Now, I know there's grace, but that's God's business, not ours. It helps our cause to know that God does not negotiate with us as an equal partner. The idea that we are equal partners or free moral agents to par with God is a lie from hell. All right. Now, next step. There's yet another consideration that is more significant than the contract. Because all contracts are not created equal. Supposing, and this happened just last week, from a real life experience. Suppose you sign a contract to replace your heating system. The term of the work is listed in clear language. The contract promises to remove the old and install the new one with specific features. When I signed or you signed the contract, I gulped these days. You entered into a valid two-party contract. One of the provisions of the contract is that if you pay, this wasn't true, but I'm using this. One of the provisions of the contract is that if you pay the contract 100% up front, there's a 10% discount for the work. Since this is an attractive option, you initial the provision. With the contract signed and the payment rendered, the salesman walks out. And I ask, what do I have? What do I have? I have a contract, that's right. What's it worth? Don't know yet. So it remains to be seen what it's worth. If the contractor shows up, does the install, where everything is according to the contract, it's a good deal. I saved 10%. However, as a salesman leaves the house with payment in hand, no one shows up to do the work, and you call to the listed number, the voice says, this number is no longer in operation. The blood runs from my face. You know the rest of the story. Well, so as in my illustration, a contract is useless unless there is a company that can and will back up the obligations. So in our case, the Bible as contract only has value if the maker of the contract can and will, not can and won't, can and will back up or perform the provisions. And I think this is where we really get in awe with what God has done, because he is up front with what he's going to do. And so many times we have said, look at that. That's exactly what happened. We talk about the Abrahamic covenant. We talk about the Jews back in the land. That's so obvious. Wow. How many years ago is that? That's almost 4,000 years ago that God made this promise with Abraham, and now the people are back in the land. 4,000 years later. What is that? Does that say anything about the contract? No, it says a lot about the contract maker, the provision provider of the contract. So the reality is that a knowledge of the maker of the contract is much more important than the very contract itself. Because we just could see that the contract was useless if my company didn't come back to install it and they got all the money. The contract could, I know there are legal recourse here, but I'm just going to say on the front of it. The reality is that my knowledge of the maker of the contract is much more important than the contract itself. In fact, I don't need the contract. If the guy is going to be good to me, says, look, I'll come and do it, and when I'm done, you pay me, no problems. Don't need to sign a contract. You've been those kind of things. That can work too. Because then we really trust the guy who said that. Well, I didn't sign a contract. That's right. My word is good. You remember that? My word is good. So we just use this illustration because God was good to us and that he rendered a contract so we did, for us to read. Let's get into that in a minute. So repeat ourselves. We gain more knowledge of the maker of the contract in its execution down the road in the future after it's been predicted that it happened the way it was. We say, wow, God can do that. We gain more from seeing him implement the contract than the contract itself. Because the contract itself is empty unless it's acted upon. Again, there is more value in watching the contract maker perform than any value in the contract itself. Which is my big story in the whole deal anyway, is it's not the contract, it's the contract maker that we're depending on. How do we know whether he's good? Well, does he perform according to the contract? That says something about his character, doesn't it? Okay. Again, we gain the most knowledge and appreciation of the contract as we see him perform. And we might say, against all odds, this will never happen, but it does happen. And he makes good his provision. As we move through the Bible, it's an astounding thing to see God perform his promises against the headwinds of the failed humanity. Doesn't matter what failed humanity does, God moves his program on. It says something about his character and less about the contract, although the contract is just incidental to what he's going to do. So while God is displeased with the grief sent his way, he does not renege on his word. Now that is a big issue, because our covenantalists want to camp on this and say, no, God changed his mind because Abraham didn't perform. Adam didn't perform, therefore God changed his mind. This is what the covenantalists cannot accept. They think God thinks like they do. And God does not think like they do, that he could not take it anymore, and he rejects the Jews. So in my interest, I go to the computer, and I look for covenant theology, history of covenant theology. First thing comes up on Ligonier Ministries, which is Sproul. By the way, he's got his theology straight now. So he's got 2.5 pages by a guy named Scott Clark, writes what the history of covenant theology. He does not mention Abraham once, except as Abraham's children, but not Abraham or anything about what the Bible says about Abraham. Doesn't say it once. He makes one Bible reference to Hebrews 6, one of the warning passages, Hebrews 6, 4 through 6, 6, 4 through 6. He used the general terms from the church fathers 5 times, depending on the church fathers for his information. He uses history 7 times, historical twice, covenant 73 times, reformation or reformed 20 times. You notice what's missing here is an argument from the Bible. It's all based on historical evidence, what people believe and what they taught. He does not react to literal meaning of the text, but does not like liberalism from their point of view to go farther than they've gone in that liberalism allows grace to go to anybody that's baptized. He said, no, just those are baptized in the household of the faith, in the household of believers. You can't put black baptism on everybody. So he disagrees with the liberal, but he doesn't say anything about the side that would look more conservative at Scripture. So in this is what he says. In the history of theology, now he wants to go back, not to the Bible, but to the history of theology, the elements of what we know as covenant theology, the covenant of redemption before time between the persons of the Trinity, covenant of redemption, covenant of works with Adam, and the covenant of grace after the fall, have existed since the early church. Why didn't he say the Bible? Because it's not a Bible. But he will overwhelm you with the number of times he uses the early church fathers, that by the time you use that, the 70 times or whatever it was he had, he said, you forgot that it was the Bible that we should go back to. He said, no, it's not in the Bible. And I ask at this point, why is this not a deal killer right now? Why do we need to have any more discussion? If you can't root your argument in the Bible, you have no case. Well, he goes on to say, indeed, Reformed leaders who turn to the early church fathers, not to the Bible, might be surprised to see how frequently the early church fathers, use language and thought patterns. You know, he's sort of like being real loose here. He knows full well it's not developed theology back here. So he has just these languages and thought patterns, not developed covenants like covenant theology has. That came later. So we see that we ought not to be surprised to see how frequently they use language and thought patterns that we find very similar or familiar. The covenant theology of the Father stressed the unity of the covenant grace, superiority of the new covenant over the Mosaic covenant, and that because Jesus is the true seed of Abraham, all Christians, whether Jews or Gentiles, are Abraham's children. Now, on that one statement rests entire change horse. You rode on this horse and you left on this horse. This is what happens. You come with Jewish promises, you leave with Gentile promises. It's this statement. Because Jesus is the true seed of Abraham, all Christians, whether Jews or Gentile, are Abraham's children. You know, I can't deny the statement. But what he lets out is, well, it's kind of like Catholics. There's so many things about the Catholics we agree with. But how about those things we don't agree with? That is missing from here. He doesn't say, but the Jews remain their national land promises or the national kingdom promises. That's not said here. So you think, well, that's all of it. No, it's not all of it. He gives you what he wants to tell you and doesn't answer the rest of the question. So here is how it works. We have Abraham, the covenant, to Isaac, to Jacob. We have two sons, twins. Jacob's son, I'm sorry, I'm not doing the wrong. Here he has two sons here. Jacob's son and a son Esau. Esau is not the selected son, but Jacob is. So Jacob has Jews that end up being of the faith of Abraham, are believers, but he also have Jews that are only of the birth of Abraham, but not of the faith of Abraham. This as a category will never have a future. They lose out because this has been going on since Abraham, in a sense, almost, since Jacob. Now, what we have is that these Jewish promises continue. Now, we skip this generation because they're out, but they get picked up later on because these Jews do receive the faith of Abraham and receive the natural promises. So we basically follow this along. And now we find what's common to them is they both are saved. So the Gentiles have the faith of Abraham, which goes back up here. Gentiles who have the same true faith of Abraham look a lot like the Jews of the same faith of Abraham. Now, during the church age, actually, they're together. The Jews and the church are together. But once the church is removed, then the Jews receive the national promises, and they want to deny that truth. They want to deny that truth. So they just basically X out the bottom of that pattern and say the Gentiles have it all. So the plot the covenantalists have hatched is long on promise and short on delivery. While it is late on arrival in 17th century, 1600, probably 1650, it must be an embarrassment to see the Jews still not disappearing in spite of all the rejection from the countries, not including U.S., as the world supposed. The covenants will not like our insistence on the Bible as contract, as was shown in our lessons. They don't want to have the Abrahamic covenant a contract. But the Abrahamic covenant is absent without leave, as we have seen in the historical covenant theology. Somewhere the believers will be confronted with the facts of a contract that God will make good. Someday they will understand it. And, you know, it's almost like, why don't they already see it? Jews are back in the land. It's a big thing. It's a big thing. All right. So if God never showed us, going back to our lesson here, if God never showed us the contract to obligate himself, are there any factors that would keep him from doing what the contract called for? I asked you that last time I taught. No. God doesn't have to tell us what he's going to do. He just needs to do it. I mean, he don't have to tell us. So the answer is no. So showing the contract is for our good, to know, predict what God will do so there are no surprises. That's accommodation for us. Revealing what God will do is a grace provision. He did not need to reveal it. He could have gone about choosing Abraham and playing out his entire plan and history. But the grace of God has allowed us to peer into his mind. That's called revelation. Not to pass judgment, but to appreciate the will maker in the deepest sense. In the words of God, the words of God are useful only through his action. So God is sharing information with his rebellious creation. This is entirely uncalled for. It is not necessary. So it's like me sharing my plans to save the termites that invaded our home. Slimy little creatures eating me alive. But the difference between us and God is greater. I had no intention to spare the brown-headed creatures, yet God exposed his plans for us, the termite, that he is going to provide a savior. Isn't that nice he told us? What grace, what condescension. While we are hoping to make an ironclad case for the Bible as contract, there lurks an elephant in the room that can destroy the entire edifice of Revelation. All things we have said so far are true, they might say. However, there is a but in the dialogue. Can you imagine what that but is? That would be good. Then we don't have a contract. They'll say, no, it's a contract. God didn't change his mind. Since yeah, right. Well, okay, we'll do it this way. What is it? You don't read the Bible literally. See, I go through all this trouble and get it all set up, ironclad contract, and I'm all said and done, and they say, I'll give you all of that, but you can't read the Bible literally. You destroyed the whole thing. You understand that? I hope you do. Literally. Well, literal is a good word. It's for contracts, for checks, and love letters, but not the Bible, they say. I said, that's so strange to me. Why in the world, everything that we ever do amongst us that's going to have any meaning at all or any bite at all is going to be a contract. But when God writes his whatever it is to us, it's not to be understood literal. You know, everything else we have is literal. Our checks are written literal. Our contracts are written literal. But when it comes to God communicating with man or stating what he's going to do, it's not literal. So where do you get that idea from? Why do I do what it says? Exactly. So I don't want to call it a contract thing because I don't have to do what it says. So quickly. So what has been painstakingly built, maybe even an ironclad case for the Bible as contract, where the character of the maker shows more or tells us more than the contract itself, all this can be destroyed in one statement. You cannot take the Bible literally. Well, then we say, well, we interpret the Bible literally. We interpret the Bible literally. So here's another one of my pet peeves. I just have a few. So then we have this infamous statement, the meaning of the Bible is not determined because it all depends on how you interpret it. That's exactly, you've heard it 100 times. If not on air, you've heard it from your friends. The meaning of the Bible is not determined. We don't know what it means because it depends on how you interpret it. And I protest, do not interpret the Bible. Read it and obey it. Interpretation is for Bible message deniers. We'll just get caught here. I'll go through this. So one of my pet peeves, I believe, we give up a vital point up front. This happens if we agree that the Bible is subject to interpretation. If we agree to that, we've given up too much. Thus, we have, because we agree then, if there are interpretations, then we have tacitly agreed that there are multiple ones. Now we're arguing about which one. I don't want to argue which one. There is only one. And I don't want to be in a position to have to argue between two kinds. I said there is only one. I'm going to, before we go on to the next subject, we've got to talk about that first. What does it say? But God did intend that there would be, did God intend that there would be multiple interpretations? If God did not intend multiple interpretations, then there is but one called interpretations. I believe that by allowing interpretations, we have left the camel's nose in the tent, and he will rule by strange interpretations. So insist on literalism and not allow literal interpretation. I know we've all used it. I know we use it. I just don't say that we have any help. We don't help ourselves by doing it. If it says something literally, make the other side say what it does not say literally. Stick with it. That's what it says. Well, it's all you interpret it. No, it's not. It's what it says. Now make them come up with a better answer. You don't want to say, well, yeah, I know it's how you interpret it. Now we've each got a vote. Well, we don't get nowhere. So here it is. The axiom is that which is clear does not need interpretation. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Is that subject to interpretation? You want to make it subject to interpretation. Well, like that guy that told Gil that Wesley said, well, I can make a lot of things say that, but I don't let him do that. What does it say? It says that. Well, I know that's what it says. That's not what I mean. What it says is what it means. Make him get off, you know, make him move. All right. That which is clear does not need interpretation. In fact, we've got a word for it. Even Jerry remembers this word. Perspicuity. We have a word to show that the Bible needs no interpretation. The word is perspicuity. It's clarity. It's easily read. That does not mean it is intuitive. You don't do it like this. Oh, I see it. You know, or I have to do work in it. No, it doesn't say that. You cannot outguess the Bible. You must become a student of it. So the Bible is clear. I mean, do we not want to admit that the Bible is clear? If we tell our friends that are not saved, the Bible is not clear, we're in trouble. We are in trouble. The Bible is clear. It is not a puzzle. Now, there may be puzzling things about it, but the Bible by its nature is not a puzzle. It is a contract clearly drawn up with a maker behind it. So it is clear God did not intend to confuse people. It's not intended to challenge people to come up with the right answer. You know, one out of a million came up. That's not what God intended. God intended everybody would know what he said, and therefore it is not subject to interpretation. It is subject to literal reading of it. Now, there are parts you might have to interpret, but that doesn't characterize the entire scripture. That's my point. So it is clear. It is not a puzzle. It is not meant to be obscure. Do not mix ignorance with obscurity. And ignorance is generally a lack of knowledge. So we say it's very difficult because you don't know. That's why. But that's nothing wrong with it, the Bible. Wow. So the foundational truth is the Bible is a contract. The maker is more important than the contract. The maker, has revealed his intention. I didn't proof this last one. The terms used are to be understood literally. There's no other way to bring usefulness to the Bible. Otherwise, it's just a book, and it could just as well be my filing cabinet.